My breasts are fingered in their turn, a search for ripeness, rot. The breathing comes nearer. I smell old smoke, aftershave, tobacco dust on hair. Then the voice, very soft, close to my head. That's him, bulging the sheet. I could help you, he says, whispers. What? I say. Shh, he says. I could help you. I've helped others. Help me? I say, my voice as low as his. How? Does he know something? Has he seen Luke? Has he found... Can he bring back... How do you think? He says, still barely breathing it. Is that his hand sliding up my leg? He's taken off the glove. The door's locked. No one will come in. They'll never know it isn't his. He lifts the sheet. The lower part of his face is covered by the white gauze mask. Regulation. Two brown eyes, a nose, a head with brown hair on it. His hand is between my legs. Most of those old guys can't make it anymore, he says, or they're sterile. I almost gasp. He's said a forbidden word. Sterile. There is no such thing as a sterile man anymore, not officially. There are only women who are fruitful and women who are barren. That's the law. Lots of women do it, he goes on. You want a baby, don't you? Yes, I say. It's true, and I don't ask why, because I know. Give me children or else I die. There's more than one meaning to it. You're soft, he says. It's time. Today or tomorrow would do it. Why waste it? It'd only take a minute, honey. What he called his wife once, maybe still does, but really it's a generic term. We are all honey. I hesitate. He's offering himself to me, his services, at some risk to himself. I hate to see what they put you through, he murmurs. It's genuine, genuine sympathy. And yet he's enjoying this, sympathy and all. His eyes are moist with compassion. His hand is moving on me nervously and with impatience. It's too dangerous, I say. No, I can't. The penalty is death. But they have to catch you in the act with two witnesses. What are the odds? Is the room bugged? Who's waiting just outside the door? His hand stops. Think about it, he says. I've seen your chart. You don't have a lot of time left, but it's your life. Thank you, I say. I must leave the impression that I'm not offended, that I'm open to suggestion. He takes his hand away, lazily almost, lingeringly. This is not the last word as far as he's concerned. He could fake the tests, report me for cancer, for infertility, have me shipped off to the colonies with the unwomen. None of this has been said, but the knowledge of his power hangs nevertheless in the air as he pats my thigh, withdraws himself behind the hanging sheet. Next month, he says. I put on my clothes again behind the screen. My hands are shaking. Why am I frightened? I've crossed no boundaries. I've given no trust, taken no risk. All is safe. It's the choice that terrifies me. A way out. A salvation. 12. The bathroom is beside the bedroom. It's papered in small blue flowers, forget-me-nots with curtains to match. There's a blue bath mat, a blue fake fur cover on the toilet seat. All this bathroom lacks from the time before is a doll whose skirt conceals the extra roll of toilet paper. Except that the mirror over the sink has been taken out and replaced by an oblong of tin, and the door has no lock, and there are no razors, of course. There were incidents in bathrooms at first. There were cuttings, drownings, before they got all the bugs ironed out. Cora sits on a chair outside in the hall to see that no one else goes in. in a bathroom, in a bathtub. You are vulnerable, said Aunt Lydia. She didn't say to what. The bath is a requirement, but is also a luxury. Merely to lift off the heavy white wings and the veil, merely to feel my own hair again with my hands is a luxury. My hair is long now, untrimmed. Hair must be long but covered, Aunt Lydia said. St. Paul said it's either that or a close shave. She laughed, that held-back neighing of hers, as if she'd told a joke. Cora has run the bath. It steams like a bowl of soup. I take off the rest of the clothes, the overdress, the white shift and petticoat, the red stockings, the loose cotton pantaloons. Pantyhose gives you crotch rot, Mara used to say. Aunt Lydia would never have used an expression like crotch rot. Unhygienic was hers. She wanted everything to be very hygienic. My nakedness is strange to me already. My body seems outdated. Did I really wear bathing suits at the beach? I did, without thought, among men, without caring that my legs, my arms, my thighs and back were on display, could be seen. Shameful, immodest. I avoid looking down at my body, not so much because it's shameful or immodest, but because I don't want to see it. I don't want to look at something that determines me so completely. I step into the water, lie down, let it hold me. The water is soft as hams. I close my eyes and she's there with me suddenly, without warning. It must be the smell of the soap. I put my face against the soft hair at the back of her neck and breathe her in baby powder and child's washed flesh and shampoo with an undertone, the faint scent of urine. This is the age she is when I'm in the bath. She comes back to me at different ages. This is how I know she's not really a ghost. If she were a ghost, she would be the same age always. One day, when she was 11 months old, just before she began to walk, a woman stole her out of a supermarket cart. It was a Saturday, which was when Luke and I did the week's shopping because both of us had jobs. She was sitting in the little baby seats they had then in supermarket carts with holes for the legs. She was happy enough, and I turned my back. The cat food section, I think it was. Luke was over at the side of the store, out of sight at the meat counter. He liked to choose what kind of meat we were going to eat during the week. He said men needed more meat than women did, and that it wasn't a superstition, and he wasn't being a jerk. Studies had been done. There were some differences, he said. He was fond of saying that, as if I was trying to prove there weren't. But mostly he said it when my mother was there. He liked to tease her. I heard her start to cry. I turned around and she was disappearing down the aisle in the arms of a woman I'd never seen before. I screamed and the woman was stopped. She must have been about 35. She was crying and saying that it was her baby. The Lord had given it to her. He'd sent her a sign. I felt sorry for her. The store manager apologized and they held her until the police came. She's just crazy, Luke said. I thought it was an isolated incident at the time. She fades. I can't keep her here with me. She's gone now. Maybe I do think of her as a ghost, the ghost of a dead girl, a little girl who died when she was 5. I remember the pictures of us I once had, me holding her, standard poses, mother and baby, locked in a frame for safety. Behind my closed eyes, I can see myself as I am now, sitting beside an open drawer or a trunk in the cellar where the baby clothes are folded away, a lock of hair cut when she was 2 in an envelope, white blonde. It got darker later. I don't have those things anymore, the clothes and the hair. I wonder what happened to all our things, looted, dumped out, carried away, confiscated. I've learned to do without a lot of things. If you have a lot of things, said Aunt Lydia, you get too attached to this material world and you forget about spiritual values. You must cultivate poverty of spirit. Blessed are the meek. She didn't go on to say anything about inheriting the earth. I lie, lapped by the water beside an open drawer that does not exist, and think about a girl who did not die when she was 5, who still does exist. I hope, though not for me. Do I exist for her? Am I a picture somewhere in the dark at the back of her mind? They must have told her I was dead. That's what they would think of doing. They would say it would be easier for her to adjust. 8, she must be now. I filled in the time I lost. I know how much there's been. They were right. It's easier to think of her as dead. I don't have to hope then or make a wasted effort. Why bash your head, said Aunt Lydia, against a wall? Sometimes she had a graphic way of putting things. I ain't got all day, says Cora's voice outside the door. It's true, she hasn't. She hasn't got all of anything. I must not deprive her of her time. I soap myself, use the scrub brush and the piece of pumice for sanding off dead skin. Such Puritan aids are supplied. I wish to be totally clean, germless, without bacteria like the surface of the moon. I will not be able to wash myself this evening, not afterwards, not for a day. It interferes, they say, and why take chances? I cannot avoid seeing now the small tattoo on my ankle. 4 digits and an I. A passport in reverse. It's supposed to guarantee that I will never be able to fade, finally, into another landscape. I am too important, too scarce for that. I am a national resource. I pull the plug, dry myself, put on my red terry cloth robe. I leave today's dress here, where Cora will pick it up to be washed. Back in the room, I dress again. The white headdress isn't necessary for the evening, because I won't be going out. Everyone in this house knows what my face looks like. The red veil goes on, though, covering my damp hair, my head, which has not been shaved. Where did I see that film about the women kneeling in the town square, hands holding them, their hair falling in clumps? What had they done? It must have been a long time ago, because I can't remember. Cora brings my supper covered on a tray. She knocks at the door before entering. I like her for that. It means she thinks I still have some of what we used to call privacy left. Thank you, I say, taking the tray from her, and she actually smiles at me, but she turns away without answering. When we're alone together, she's shy of me. I put the tray on the small white-painted table and draw the chair up to it. I take the cover off the tray. The thigh of a chicken, overcooked. It's better than bloody, which is the other way she does it. Rita has ways of making her resentments felt. A baked potato, green beans, salad, canned pears for dessert. It's good enough food, though bland. Healthy food. You have to get your vitamins and minerals, said Aunt Lydia coyly. You must be a worthy vessel. No coffee or tea, though. No alcohol. Studies have been done. There's a paper napkin, as in cafeterias. I think of the others, those without. This is the heartland here. I'm leading a pampered life. May the Lord make us truly grateful, said Aunt Lydia. Or was it thankful? And I start to eat the food. I'm not hungry tonight. I feel sick to my stomach. But there's no place to put the food, no potted plants, and I won't chance the toilet. I'm too nervous, that's what it is. Could I leave it on the plate? Ask Cora not to report me? I chew and swallow. Chew and swallow, feeling the sweat come out. In my stomach, the food balls itself together, a handful of damp cardboard squeezed. Downstairs in the dining room, There will be candles on the large mahogany table, a white cloth, silver, flowers, wine glasses with wine in them. There will be the click of knives against china, a click as she sets down her fork with a barely audible sigh, leaving half the contents of her plate untouched. Possibly she will say she has no appetite. Possibly she won't say anything. If she says something, does he comment? If she doesn't say anything, does he notice? I wonder how she manages to get herself noticed. I think it must be hard. There's a pat of butter on the side of the plate. I tear off a corner of the paper napkin, wrap the butter in it, take it to the cupboard, and slip it into the toe of my right shoe from the extra pair as I have done before. I crumple up the rest of the napkin. No one surely will bother to smooth it out, to check if any is missing. I will use the butter later tonight. It would not do this evening to smell of butter. I wait. I compose myself. Myself is a thing I must now compose as one composes a speech. What I must present is a made thing, not something born. Nap. 13. There's time to spare. This is one of the things I wasn't prepared for, the amount of unfilled time, the long parentheses of nothing. Time as white sound. If only I could embroider, weave, knit, something to do with my hands. I want a cigarette. I remember walking in art galleries through the 19th century, the obsession they had then with harems. Dozens of paintings of harems, fat women lolling on divans, turbans on their heads or velvet caps being fanned with peacock tails, a eunuch in the background standing guard. Studies of sedentary flesh painted by men who'd never been there. These pictures were supposed to be erotic, and I thought they were at the time, but I see now what they were really about. They were paintings about suspended animation, about waiting, about objects not in use. They were paintings about boredom. But maybe boredom is erotic when women do it for men. I wait, washed, brushed, fed like a prize pig. Sometime in the 80s, they invented pig balls for pigs who were being fattened in pens. Pig balls were large, colored balls. The pigs rolled them around with their snouts. The pig marketeers said this improved their muscle tone. The pigs were curious. They liked to have something to think about. I read about that in Introduction to Psychology, that and the chapter on caged rats who'd give themselves electric shocks for something to do, and the one on the pigeons trained to peck a button that made a grain of corn appear. Three groups of them. The first got one grain per peck, the second one grain every other peck, the third was random. When the man in charge cut off the grain, the first group gave up quite soon, the second group a little later. The third group never gave up. They'd peck themselves to death rather than quit. Who knew what worked? I wish I had a pig ball. I lie down on the braided rug. You can always practice, said Aunt Lydia. Several sessions a day, fit it into your daily routine. Arms at the sides, knees bent, lift the pelvis, roll the backbone down, tuck. Again. Breathe in to the count of five, hold, expel. We'd do that in what used to be the domestic science room, cleared now of sewing machines and washer-dryers, in unison, lying on little Japanese mats, a tape playing. Les selfies. That's what I hear now in my head as I lift, tilt, breathe, behind my closed eyes, Thin white dancers flit gracefully among the trees, their legs fluttering like the wings of held birds. In the afternoon, we lay on our beds for an hour in the gymnasium between 3 and 4. They said it was a period of rest and meditation. I thought then they did it because they wanted some time off themselves from teaching us, and I know the ants, not on duty, went off to the teacher's room for a cup of coffee or whatever they called by that name. But now I think that the rest also was practice. They were giving us a chance to get used to blank time. A catnap, Aunt Lydia called it in her coy way. The strange thing is, we needed the rest. Many of us went to sleep. We were tired there a lot of the time. We were on some kind of pill or drug, I think. They put it in the food to keep us calm, but maybe not. Maybe it was the place itself. After the first shock, after you'd come to terms, it was better to be lethargic. You could tell yourself you were saving up your strength. I must have been there 3 weeks when Mara came. She was brought into the gymnasium by two of the aunts in the usual way while we were having our nap. She still had her other clothes on, jeans and a blue sweatshirt. Her hair was short. She defied fashion as usual, so I recognized her at once. She saw me too, but she turned away. She already knew what was safe. There was a bruise on her left cheek turning purple. The aunts took her to a vacant bed where the red dress was already laid out. She undressed, began to dress again in silence, the aunts standing at the end of the bed, the rest of us watching from inside our slitted eyes. As she bent over, I could see the knobs on her spine. I couldn't talk to her for several days. We looked only, small glances like sips. Friendships were suspicious. We knew it. We avoided each other during the mealtime lineups in the cafeteria and in the halls between classes. But on the fourth day, she was beside me during the walk, 2 by 2, around the football field. We weren't given the white wings until we graduated. We had only the veils, so we could talk as long as we did it quietly and didn't turn to look at one another. The aunts walked at the head of the line and at the end, so the only danger was from the others. Some were believers and might report us. "This is a loony bin," Mara said. "I'm so glad to see you," I said. "Where can we talk?" said Mara. "Washroom," I said. "Watch the clock. End stall. 2:30. That was all we said. It makes me feel safer that Mara is here. We can go to the washroom if we put our hands up, though there's a limit to how many times a day. They mark it down on a chart. I watched the clock, electric and round, at the front over the green blackboard. 2:30 comes during testifying. Aunt Helena is here, as well as Aunt Lydia, because testifying is special. Aunt Helena is fat. She once headed a Weight Watchers franchise operation in Iowa. She's good at testifying. It's Janine, telling about how she was gang-raped at 14 and had an abortion. She told the same story last week. She seemed almost proud of it while she was telling. It may not even be true. At testifying, it's safer to make things up than to say you have nothing to reveal. But since it's Janine, it's probably more or less true. "But whose fault was it?" Aunt Helena says, holding up one plump finger. "Her fault, her fault, her fault," we chant in unison. "Who led them on?" Aunt Helena beams, pleased with us. "She did. She did. She did. Why did God allow such a terrible thing to happen? Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Last week, Janine burst into tears. Aunt Helena made her kneel at the front of the classroom, hands behind her back, where we could all see her, her red face and dripping nose. Her hair, dull blonde, her eyelashes so light they seemed not there, the lost eyelashes of someone who's been in a fire, burned eyes. She looked disgusting, weak, squirmy, blotchy, pink, like a newborn mouse. None of us wanted to look like that, ever. For a moment, even though we knew what was being done to her, we despised her. Cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby. We meant it, which is the bad part. I used to think well of myself. I didn't then. That was last week. This week, Janine doesn't wait for us to jeer at her. It was my fault, she says. It was my own fault. I led them on. I deserved the pain. Very good, Janine, says Aunt Lydia. You are an example. I have to wait until this is over before I put up my hand. Sometimes, if you ask at the wrong moment, they say no. If you really have to go, that can be crucial. Yesterday, Dolores wept the floor. Two aunts hauled her away, a hand under each armpit. She wasn't there for the afternoon walk, but at night she was back in her usual bed. All night we could hear her moaning off and on. What did they do to her? We whispered from bed to bed. I don't know. Not knowing makes it worse. I raise my hand. Aunt Lydia nods. I stand up and walk out into the hall as inconspicuously as possible. Outside the washroom, Aunt Elizabeth is standing guard. She nods, signaling that I can go in. This washroom used to be for boys. The mirrors have been replaced here, too, by oblongs of dull gray metal, but the urinals are still there on one wall, white enamel with yellow stains. They look oddly like babies' coffins. I marvel again at the nakedness of men's lives, the showers right out in the open, the body exposed for inspection and comparison, the public display of privates. What is it for? What purposes of reassurance does it serve? The flashing of a badge. Look, everyone, all is in order. I belong here. Why don't women have to prove to one another that they are women? Some form of unbuttoning, some split crotch routine, just as casual, a dog-like sniffing. The high school is old. The stalls are wooden, some kind of chipboard. I go into the second one from the end, swing the door to. Of course, there are no longer any locks. In the wood, there's a small hole at the back next to the wall, about waist height, souvenir of some previous vandalism or legacy of an ancient voyeur. Everyone in the center knows about this hole in the woodwork, everyone except the ants. I'm afraid I am too late, held up by Janine's testifying. Maybe Maura has been here already. Maybe she's had to go back. They don't give you much time. I look carefully down, aslant, under the stall wall, and there are two red shoes. But how can I tell who it is? I put my mouth to the wooden hole. Maura, I whisper. Is that you? She says. Yes, I say. Relief goes through me. God, do I need a cigarette, says Maura. Me too, I say. I feel ridiculously happy. I sink down into my body as into a swamp, fenland, where only I know the footing. Treacherous ground, my own territory. I become the earth. I set my ear against for the rumors of the future. Each twinge, each murmur of slight pain, ripples of sloughed-off matter, swellings and diminishings of tissue, the droolings of the flesh, these are signs. These are the things I need to know about. Each month, I watch for blood, fearfully, for when it comes, it means failure. I have failed once again to fulfill the expectations of others, which may have become my own. I used to think of my body as an instrument of pleasure, or a means of transportation, or an implement for the accomplishment of my will. I could use it to run, push buttons of one sort or another, make things happen. There were limits, but my body was nevertheless lithe, single, solid, one with me. Now the flesh arranges itself differently. I'm a cloud, congealed around a central object, the shape of a pear which is hard and more real than I am and glows red within its translucent wrapping. Inside it is a space, huge as the sky at night and dark and curved like that, though black-red rather than black. Pinpoints of light swell, sparkle, burst and shrivel within it, countless as stars. Every month, there is a moon, gigantic, round, heavy, an omen. It transits, pauses, continues on and passes out of sight, and I see despair coming toward me like famine. To feel that empty again, again. I listen to my heart, wave upon wave, salty and red, continuing on and on, marking time. I'm in our first apartment, in the bedroom. I'm standing in front of the cupboard, which has folding doors made of wood. Around me, I know it's empty. All the furniture is gone, the floors are bare, no carpets even. But despite this, the cupboard is full of clothes. I think they're my clothes, but they don't look like mine. I've never seen them before. Maybe they're clothes belonging to Luke's wife, whom I've also never seen. Only pictures and a voice on the phone late at night when she was calling us before the divorce. But no, they're my clothes, all right. I need a dress. I need something to wear. I pull out dresses. Black, blue, purple, jackets, skirts. None of them will do. None of them even fits. They're too big or too small. Luke is there, behind me. I turn to see him. He won't look at me. He looks down at the floor where the cat is rubbing itself against his legs, mewing and mewing plaintively. It wants food. But how can there be any food with the apartment so empty? Luke, I say. He doesn't answer. Maybe he doesn't hear me. It occurs to me that he may not be alive. I am running with her, holding her hand, pulling, dragging her through the bracken. She's only half awake because of the pill I gave her, so she wouldn't cry or say anything that would give us away. She doesn't know where she is. The ground is uneven, rocks, dead branches, the smell of damp earth. Old leaves. She can't run fast enough. By myself, I could run faster. I'm a good runner. Now she's crying. She's frightened. I want to carry her, but she would be too heavy. I have my hiking boots on, and I think when we reach the water, I'll have to kick them off. Will it be too cold? Will she be able to swim that far? What about the current? We weren't expecting this. Quiet, I say to her angrily. I think about her drowning. And this thought slows me. Then the shots come behind us. Not loud, not like firecrackers, but sharp and crisp, like a dry branch snapping. It sounds wrong. Nothing ever sounds the way you think it will. And I hear the voice. Down. Is it a real voice? Or a voice inside my head, or my own voice, out loud? I pull her to the ground and roll on top of her to cover her, shield her. Quiet, I say again. My face is wet, sweat or tears. I feel calm and floating, as if I'm no longer in my body. Close to my eyes, there's a leaf, red, turned early. I can see every bright vein. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I ease off. I don't want to smother her. Instead, I curl myself around her, keeping my hand over her mouth. There's breath and the knocking of my heart, like pounding at the door of a house at night, where you thought you would be safe. It's all right, I'm here, I say. Whisper, please be quiet. But how can she? She's too young. It's too late. We come apart. My arms are held, and the edges go dark, and nothing is left but a little window, a very little window, like the wrong end of a telescope, like the window on a Christmas card, an old one, night and ice outside, and within a candle, a shining tree, a family. I can hear the bells even, sleigh bells from the radio, old music. But through this window I can see, small but very clear, I can see her going away from me through the trees which are already turning red and yellow, holding out her arms to me, being carried away. The bell awakens me, and then Cora knocking at my door. I sit up on the rug, wipe my wet face with my sleeve. Of all the dreams, this is the worst.
Household 14. When the bell has finished, I descend the stairs, a brief waif in the eye of glass that hangs on the downstairs wall. The clock ticks with its pendulum, keeping time. My feet in their neat red shoes count the way down. The sitting room door is wide open. I go in. So far no one is here. I don't sit, but take my place, kneeling near the chair with the footstool, where Serena Joy will shortly enthrone herself, leaning on her cane while she lowers herself down. Possibly she'll put a hand on my shoulder to steady herself as if I'm a piece of furniture. She's done it before. The sitting room would once have been called a drawing room, perhaps then a living room, or maybe it's a parlor, the kind with a spider and flies, but now it's officially a sitting room because that's what is done in it by some. For others, there's standing room only. The posture of the body is important. Here and now, minor discomforts are instructive. The sitting room is subdued, symmetrical. It's one of the shapes money takes when it freezes. Money has trickled through this room for years and years, as if through an underground cavern, crusting and hardening like stalactites into these forms. Mutely, the varied surfaces present themselves. The dusk rose velvet of the drawn drapes, the gloss of the matching chairs, 18th century, the cow's tongue hush of the tufted Chinese rug on the floor, with its peach-pink peonies, the suave leather of the commander's chair, the glint of brass on the box beside it. The rug is authentic. Some things in this room are authentic, some are not. For instance, two paintings, both of women, one on either side of the fireplace. Both wear dark dresses like the ones in the old church, though of a later date. The paintings are possibly authentic. I suspect that when Serena Joy acquired them, after it became obvious to her that she'd have to redirect her energies into something convincingly domestic, she had the intention of passing them off as ancestors. Or maybe they were in the house when the commander bought it. There's no way of knowing such things. In any case, there they hang, their backs and mouths stiff, their breasts constricted, their faces pinched, their caps
starched, their skin grayish-white, guarding the room with their narrowed eyes. Between them, over the mantel, there's an oval mirror flanked by two pairs of silver candlesticks, with a white china cupid centered between them, its arm around the neck of a lamb. The tastes of Serena Joy are a strange blend, hard lust for quality, soft, sentimental cravings. There's a dried flower arrangement on either end of the mantelpiece and a vase of real daffodils on the polished marquetry end table beside the sofa. The room smells of lemon oil, heavy cloth, fading daffodils, the leftover smells of cooking that have made their way from the kitchen or the dining room, and of Serena Joy's perfume, Lily of the Valley. Perfume is a luxury. She must have some private source. I breathe it in, thinking I should appreciate it. It's the scent of pre-pubescent girls, of the gifts young children used to give their mothers for Mother's Day, the smell of white cotton socks and white cotton petticoats, of dusting powder, of the innocence of female flesh not yet given over to hairiness and blood. It makes me feel slightly ill, as if I'm in a closed car on a hot, muggy day with an older woman wearing too much face powder. This is what the sitting room is like, despite its elegance. I would like to steal something from this room. I would like to take some small thing, the scrolled ashtray, the little silver pillbox from the mantel, perhaps, or a dried flower, hide it in the folds of my dress or in my zippered sleeve, keep it there until this evening is over, secrete it in my room, under the bed or in a shoe or in a slit in the hard petty point faith cushion. Every once in a while I would take it out and look at it. It would make me feel that I have power. But such a feeling would be an illusion and too risky. My hands stay where they are, folded in my lap, thighs together, heels tucked underneath me, pressing up against my body, head lowered. In my mouth there's the taste of toothpaste, fake mint and plaster. I wait for the household to assemble. Household, that is what we are. The commander is the head of the household. The house is what he holds, to have and to hold, till death do us part. The hold of a ship. Hollow. Cora comes in first, then Rita, wiping her hands on her apron. They too have been summoned by the bell. They resent it. They have other things to do, the dishes, for instance. But they need to be here. They all need to be here. The ceremony demands it. We are all obliged to sit through this one way or another. Rita scowls at me before slipping in to stand behind me. It's my fault, this waste of her time. Not mine, but my body's, if there is a difference. Even the commander is subject to its whims. Nick walks in, nods to all three of us, looks around the room. He too takes his place behind me, standing. He's so close that the tip of his boot is touching my foot. Is this on purpose? Whether it is or not, we are touching two shapes of leather. I feel my shoe soften. Blood flows into it. It grows warm. It becomes a skin. I move my foot slightly away. "Wish he'd hurry up," says Cora. "Hurry up and wait," says Nick. He laughs. Moves his foot so it's touching mine again. No one can see beneath the folds of my outspread skirt. I shift. It's too warm in here. The smell of stale perfume makes me a little sick. I move my foot away.
This ends side two of cassette two. Please stop the tape before fast-forwarding to the end and loading cassette three.